Hi, I'm Terry Meekin. Welcome to Roving Report. If you think you're in control of your life, then think again. You're not. It's your DNA that controls you. Your DNA contains the plans to build you and lays down your individuality. Who you are, what you do, what you think, and how you're kept alive. Your DNA is a chemical code built like a twisted ladder with 3 billion rungs. To find out how much we actually know about this code and how it works, I visited the Sanger Research Institute, where 1,400 scientists are trying to decode the instructions. First up, Don Powell.
Every cell in our body, and there are probably 100 million million of them, contains a complete copy of the instructions to build us. And that set of instructions is called our genome. It's made up of a chemical called DNA. And that DNA is actually built of 4 chemical subunits, genetic letters. It's the order of those letters that contains the instructions, the code to build a human. So all humans contain roughly the same sort of genome, looking very, very similar. 20,000 genes that contain instructions, and any two of us will differ at about 1 in 1,000 positions. So you and I will differ at about 3 million of those 3 billion positions, letters in our DNA.
Are these differences in the DNA differences to be expected because of colour of skin, pigmentation, or are we talking about including mutations which actually can cause diseases and problems?
They're all of those things. I've got glasses, my mother had glasses, my grandmother had glasses. Perhaps I've got a gene variant that makes my eye muscles weak or the lens weak. So there are some that are important in that way, but there are some that are really, really important for our health. And we know that because we can see genetic diseases in families.
When you have the original DNA and it tells the body how to make things at where and at what time, does that DNA program and become redundant some part in its life because it says, right, I've done my job now, I've made the bones, I can just switch myself off and that's it? Or does it have a maintenance function after that?
That's a very good question. Do parts of the genome turn off as we become specialised cells or tissues? Full set of instructions are in every cell, so you have to specialise. You're absolutely right. You have to turn bits off, and so you don't
as
want...
you just continue growing to
So you start off as one fertilised cell from the moment when you're conceived, and you turn into 100 million million cells. That has to stop at some time,
yes.
Or else you become a great blob. But also, I don't want the red blood protein, hemoglobin, to be made in the lens of my eye. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to see. So the gene for hemoglobin, or genes for hemoglobin, are switched off in the eye. And same goes on in every other tissue. Certain genes have to be turned off, certain have to be turned on. But there also has to be this limit, this sense of you have grown enough and now you must stop. And so there's a whole suite, a whole network of controls in which the
So every cell in the body is looking after its particular environment.
All the cells in our body are programmed during our development to turn certain genes on and certain genes off. Cells then live in an environment where other cells talk to them. So cells are in contact, talk to one another through the membrane that surrounds them. But also parts of our body talk to other parts of the body through the nervous system. Nervous impulses make my muscles work, make my mouth work, make my vocal cords go tight and slack. But also hormones control the way in which you operate. So when we eat, the hormones that are required to mobilize everything to digest our food are mobilized. So there's an extensive set of communication networks within cells, between cells, and between organs and tissues that actually make us work. And it's important that we don't lose sight when we are doing biology of thinking we'll concentrate on gene A and forget about all the other.
How does a gene communicate with another gene? What's the pathway? Is it a chemical pathway? Is it a chemical compound?
The function of genes is to contain the code to build proteins, which are the molecules that do stuff. So myosin is a muscle protein. Crystalline is the protein, one of the proteins in the lens of the eye. Globin is the protein that carries oxygen around. There are genes in our body that control the activity of other genes. And there's a range of different special types. But in most cases, they contain the code to make a protein that will switch on another gene or another switch.
So it's a protein which switches on a gene. That's what it is. The proteins vary in their structure, and then the genes act accordingly. Is that how it operates?
Yes, that is. The proteins recognize the gene that they want to turn on, or the protein surrounding surrounding that gene, and then they open up the DNA, and the DNA is made active.
So what's the interface between the protein and the gene that actually does the work?
That's a very difficult question and a very complicated answer.
Because that really is core. That's the plug that goes into the socket.
It's also the process, and that's why it's complicated. A gene is a stretch of DNA letters, perhaps several thousand letters in length. Either side of it, in most cases, are sequences of DNA that act as part of the control mechanism, the rheostats, the knobs that we twist to turn the volume up and down. But those don't act alone. They're actually encased within proteins. And so there's a suite of proteins that will be bound there. And other proteins will interact with those proteins and either open up that gene for business, turn the rheostat up, or close it down, dampen it down, flick the off switch. So the interactions mostly are actually proteins with proteins allowing that DNA to become active. Mm. But it's actually way more complicated than that.
What you thought was junk DNA is actually considered now to be a means and a mechanism of genes talking together.
The term junk DNA is a great one that I particularly like. I think most of us have thought that junk DNA can't be doing nothing.
Everything has a purpose.
Everything has a purpose under the sun. When I was at the bench, one of the things I was trying to do was actually show if it isn't the sequence important, perhaps it's structurally that DNA is important, because the DNA has to be wound up in our cells. So maybe we need structure to the DNA to allow these genes to work properly. So that's one answer. There's a difference between junk and trash. Trash is stuff that you throw out. Junk is stuff you put in a drawer just in case you need it one day. Mm. It might be historical legacy. It might be an important part of our future. But yes, there's a study that we were part of, which is called ENCODE, that showed that much of this area of the genome that we thought to be junk, in fact, does have a role in working today.
We talk about evolutionary processes. We used to swim in the water, and then maybe that DNA that came with us was no longer used. Is that what you would term as a junk function of certain parts of the DNA structure?
Yeah, not quite literally in that way, but as a sort of metaphor for what goes on, our genome is actually a historical record, and in many ways it's not ideally suited to our life today, because evolution works over many, many years, many generations. So we have a genome that was fit maybe for, I don't know, several thousand years ago or something.
Can one fortify the DNA so that somebody that might be weak in a certain area can have it self-repair?
Our genome is 3 billion letters, and every time a cell divides, we have to copy those letters. So let's put that in context. That's a stack of A4 paper covered in courier 10-point, 70 metres high. That's 3 billion letters. 700,000 sheets of paper. Our cells have to copy that every time they divide, ideally without mistake. That doesn't happen. Mistakes are made. So we have a range of repair mechanisms in our cells, and all organisms have this. Humans aren't unusual. We have a range of repair mechanisms that go along doing proofreading, copy editing, looking for mistakes and trying to correct them. Sometimes those mistakes are corrected, sometimes they're missed.
Are those genes in their own right that are looking at the proofreading?
There is a set of genes, the DNA correction proteins, the genes correct DNA. Yeah. Right.
When a gene mutates and it doesn't repair, are they overlooked? If they've not done the job correctly, or are there some which are not capable of being repaired by these genes?
One of the amazing things that you and I can sit today and have this conversation is, in fact, because DNA repair mechanism works so well. Because we've gone from a single fertilised egg to 100 million million cells today, and basically we kind of look pretty similar and we can communicate. And that's in part because the DNA repair mechanisms has given us cells that work today. It's quite staggering that 3 billion letters copied over and over again works as well as it has. However, things happen, and sometimes mutations will be created from mutation-causing things such as tobacco smoke or sunlight or chemicals, and those mutations might be corrected or they might not. And also some copying mechanisms will occur. Malignant melanoma affects something like 60,000, 70,000 people around the world, and somewhere between a half and two-thirds of those cases are due to a mutation. In fact, one particular mutation in a gene called BRAF. And BRAF makes a protein that acts like a chemical switch in a cell, and it switches a cell on, so the cell then divides. And one aspect of cancer is cells divide when they shouldn't and where they shouldn't. Uncontrolled division. So the mutation in BRAF was discovered here, never been seen before. And in fact, the BRAF mutation and its treatment is a remarkable success story of genome science, because the discovery was made in 2002. There were treatments in the clinic in the US in 2009. Most often from discovery to treatment takes perhaps 15 years in the UK. It takes maybe 5 years to build that research and maybe 5 to 10 years, maybe longer, to do the clinical trials. With melanoma and with all cancers, what you're doing when you treat it is this treatment for melanoma recognizes the mutant protein and binds to it and clamps it down and makes it less active. And that stops the cells dividing, that stops the cancer spreading. You can then try to clear the cancer up with other treatments. The thing about cancer is it's about cells dividing. Cells dividing are about evolution. Evolution is about cell division and what happens to the next generation of cells, or people, or flies, or birds. When we apply a limit to a cell growth, as we do in treating cancer, then potentially we've got a situation set up where resistance will occur. Because we're killing cells, any cell that acquires a mutation that makes it resistant to that treatment will then prosper. It will escape the treatment. And that happens in some cancer therapies where some A cell acquires a mutation at random, but that random mutation makes it more resistant to the drug. Those cells can then prosper and the cancer can return.
How is the research you're doing here going to impact the general population?
This is the most exciting time in human genetics. It has never been a time when we have begun to see how it is our genetics works and how it is that we can begin to see ways to help patients. We need to understand how biology works. We need to understand the chemistry that lies behind diabetes. But we're beginning to get those pictures now because we have the power to look at many thousands of samples from many thousands of patients across many thousands of genes. It's a big part of this is computing power and very clever people working, making those computers work, writing the software, interpreting the data.
So, if we're trying to understand this chemical code and understand how it interacts with the cells in our bodies, how do we go about it? Well, apparently, it's done with a process known as sequencing. We're next off to a room where all this sequencing takes place. Put on your ear defenders and listen to John Woodward explaining how it works.
So these are our current generation sequencing machines.
So what we're looking at here is a small mini fridge on the right, married to, it's like a small desktop computer. But what actually is inside there?
It's lots of reagents, it's lots of liquids and fluids and so on. Inside here, we then enter a prepared sample of DNA.
The piece of DNA goes in there.
Well, you have multiple copies, thousands and thousands and thousands of copies, on what we call a flow cell. It's kind of like almost like a glass slide that you, put under a microscope. Sort of like that. It has lines and corridors in it. And in there, you have very small molecules already attached to that. And what happens is the DNA flows across the top of that. And as it's doing so, attaches itself to the DNA that is actually already on the glass slide. For a process of voodoo and jiggery-pokery, those strands of DNA that you've then flowed across the cell...
Your input,
get extended. And each one of those little bits of extension have something called a fluorophore on them. They basically, they emit a certain colour of light when they get attached. So each one will be an analogue for a base. So you've got your A, your T, your G, your C, and you're adding a variation of an A, T, G, or C to that strand to make a secondary copy of that strand.
So have you got four colours in this particular...
You have, yes.
So this machine picks up the four colours of the four elements of the
DNA. Yes, it
is.
Yeah. So every time a little base is added, a little light flash appears of a particular colour, and the machine will pick it up and register that as that's that particular
and
base.
What's the definition of a base?
A base is... Oh, crikey. That's quite a tricky one to say.
Simplistically, are you saying it's a base? I mean, what would you describe it as in this particular... Is it an element with the four letters on it? Is that what it is?
No, it's actually a very small chemical compound. It's a ring-shaped compound. Lots of carbons, lots of hydrogens, lots of oxygens, all particularly arranged in a particular way. And each one is slightly different in shape, so they kind of lock together when they actually join within the DNA molecule itself.
Right.
So that's why only A will go with T, and that's why C will only go with G.
So a DNA molecule consists of these bases?
Yes.
Right.
And millions of them.
Millions of them in one DNA molecule?
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay. So we got one DNA molecule, and it's a DNA molecule which has got the four letters on it, joining all each other together. So basically you're looking inside the DNA molecule.
Yes, so effectively we're reading that code. So we're looking along the length of it, and we're reading each letter as it gets adjoined in these machines.
Yeah.
So will it be an A? Yeah. Oh, there's the light for an A. Will it be a C? There's the light for a C. Will it be a G? There's a light, and so on and so on and so on.
So just to reiterate then, are we talking about the human genome being billions of letters long, and within each four-letter DNA piece, there are millions of variations of molecules inside those?
No, not quite.
Not quite. Yeah,
the structure is different. It's literally a linear molecule. So each one of these bases is a standalone molecule that will then attach to its opposite, the A or T or C or G. And that's how you read off. So from one end, it will start with a particular base, and then it will complement with its other base. And then there will be pairs of these along the whole molecule. They call them triplets. It's basically a triplet of the code will then code for a protein, and that's what makes us or plants or animals and so on and so on and so on.
So our input are these bases.
Yes.
Our output is what? From the machine?
Our output is the opposite copy of what we've already inputted. So because we know that only those bases will go with each other, if you say, for instance, have a code that says ACCCA, I know that the opposite code that I'm going to add in will be TGGGT. Because it's only the opposite base that will attach to it.
So we've got the input in the bases, we've got the output, it's the opposite of what we put in.
Yes.
What does that tell us?
It only tells us the structure of the DNA molecule.
Is that
because
all?
DNA in its natural form is double-stranded.
We don't know, in other words, what it actually is as we put it in. We don't know its structure.
No.
We only know its structure when we get the output and tie the two together.
Correct.
So this is effectively... We don't know what we're putting in, but we know what we're getting out.
Yes,
in
a very basic way, that's correct.
So there's the feedback loop.
Yes.
Okay. And then what do we do with that when you've got that piece of knowledge?
Well, that gets outputted by these machines to a huge database, enormous database, one of the biggest databases on the planet.
And it's just simply pure research. You're just throwing the stuff out there just simply to get the knowledge of what it's all made up of. There isn't somebody coming along saying, look, we've got a real problem here with this particular disease. We need to focus in on this particular area.
Oh, from that angle, no, that's not... Actually, that is a good point. A lot of... projects, because obviously, as I said, the human genome itself is finished. We've got the whole thing from beginning to end. What we're trying to do now is that we're trying to understand what that means. And each one of the smaller projects that we have are effectively doing that. Mm. So they will take their own particular region of interest, and they will want to do extra sequencing to figure out why is this interacting with this, or what is that doing with that? Mm. How does this affect this? And so on and so on and so on. So they will actually have their own little sequencing projects where they will take these little bits of DNA that they want to know about, and they will have their own special interest within the sequencing.
How do they know which bits of DNA to take out was related to that particular project? Let's say there's one that wants to look at the effect of the DNA variations on social behaviour. I saw that's one that you're doing here. How do they know which piece of DNA to look for?
It's effectively copy and compare, and it's a lot of that. So, for instance, because
don't we... Don't your finger in the air.
Oh, well, to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, we did it first. When it first started, it was finger in the air, you know, look and see what happens. Now it's... we have a lot of data that we can then go and mine. So we, for instance, have in vitro models where we know what particular genes will do. Or we have animal models where we know what that particular gene will do. And what we can do is then take a piece of DNA that we're not entirely sure about, and we can compare against what we do know about and find out, actually... Is this what this does? Have I been looking at the right thing? How does it interact with all these different genes?
So you already have models which tell you how bones are built, how proteins pass around the body. You have some very basic areas of...
To a level, yes. Yes.
And then you're saying that if you want to look at things that you don't know about, you take the ones you do know about, and then you compare the two and
correct.
See how they vary.
Correct, yes.
And then how do you actually prove that the ones that you think do these things that you're looking for, like... looking, as we say, that particular project, the antisocial project, or another project. How do you know that it's going to do the task eventually when it gets over to a manufacturer that you want it to do?
Two or three ways. In vitro is the most simple way of doing things. So basically, you would grow cells. So bacterial cells, for instance, you would end up doing an experiment and having your particular gene expressed in a particular kind of cell, and then you can literally physically look at it and understand what is going on.
Right. So that's a key point then, really. So all DNA sequencing can be converted into cells.
Yeah, because DNA is universal.
And then you can look at those cells and see where they go from there and what they're going to do.
Yes.
The ones you don't know about.
Yeah.
So there are established models of DNA which have been turned into cells which you know do certain things.
Yes.
And that's where this experimentation can say, okay, we want to regenerate a person in a certain way, talking about teeth or bones or whatever, then we know the mechanism as to how those things are created from basic DNA.
We're still in the process of understanding that. A lot of what you just suggested there, I mean, it sounds very futuristic, and it's also very scary to a certain extent to a lot of people, but actually that is stuff that's going to be happening in the future.
That's what people need.
It is, but it's going to be happening a little bit further on. Things like that will happen. We're not there yet.
How long's a bit further on?
Right. Again, we're back to that, how long is a piece of string? We've still got a lot to understand, so we can't...
You're the man with the tape measure.
Yeah, well, we're still in the process of actually pulling out the tape. Basically, you could look at it as like we're a bunch of archaeologists sorting things out to put into a museum. And us guys here at the Sanger Institute, the guys that are doing this kind of stuff, we're the guys digging the stuff out of the ground.
In order for you to recognise what you're digging out, you have to put it through this machine. So you've dug all the pieces out, and then you do what with them?
So once all the pieces are out, and we've sort of like then kind of cleaned them up and presented them, we then give them to the people like the EBI. Now, the European Bioinformatics Institute, they're the guys that effectively go and look at all this data, and they curate it. They're the guys that are in the museum putting it on stands. They're the ones that are putting it in shelves and so on and so on and so on. So sort of like say, actually, this is what we found. And then you've got the other guys, the researchers. They're the guys that are out in the main wide field of everything that we do. They're then looking at those museum pieces, and they're kind of going, oh, that's quite interesting. Wonder what I can get from that. And they're going to take that information away and work on that. And they're the guys that are probably going to have the long-term interest with what we're producing.
And it's a great analogy. And the only main difference between it is what archaeologists are dealing with are dead objects. You're actually dealing with living objects.
Correct.
So effectively, even though it's in a museum and it's on show to everybody, it's actually a living object that can be taken and recreated or manipulated.
Let's say that the DNA would be able to give... It has the potential for life. What we've got is a huge amount of digital data. There's actually not that much in terms of the wet chemistry, the wet lab stuff that we've actually done. A lot of it is just huge, huge amounts of data.
Right.
And that is effectively what the EBI are doing. They're the guys that are sort of like putting all these bits together and putting it on the shelves and kind of sort of like saying, actually, this is what we're doing. And you do all these through web interfaces. You can do it through special applications that you can go into. It's completely open access to everybody.
But if we take DNA, imagine DNA being a product in a business. A business relies on customers and customer demand for the manufacturer, if you like, to make what it is the customers want.
Mm-hmm.
So do you get requests from the medical industry to say, look, we actually desperately need a tool or a cure for this particular disease or whatever. Can you focus on that, please? Because we need that at the moment and we'll pay something towards it.
In a roundabout way, yes. It's not that general, I have to say. We've got a project that's up and running now called the 100,000 Genome Project. It's a government-funded thing, but we've got the expertise to be able to carry it out for the government. It's been a request to sort of like kind of make a comparison of 100,000 people's genomes who have got cancer, and they've taken samples from this cancer, and what they're effectively doing is taking a comparison of all of these different kinds of cancers and finding out what the differences are between each one of these cancers. Now, it's a very, very, very big and involved project, and will be running for quite some time. But that is effectively a request to a certain extent that has come from outside that we're doing the work for.
And that, of course, is where the general public are interested in, know the practical applications of the research we're doing here when it's going to hit the high street. And there's an obvious one for that type of thing.
Yes.
So, that's how we get to read the code that makes up samples of DNA. But how do we know what they mean? How do we find out what the different parts of the DNA ladder do? Well, Jenny Hill's next up to give us some practical indications how scientists take information from sequencing to find out what the body actually does with these instructions.
People's genetic makeup influences their susceptibility to a whole range of different diseases. Cancer, for instance, or heart disease. We understand a little bit about how different variants of genes, when some people have one particular variant, one mutation, then their chances of getting a certain disease are a lot higher. And we know this is the case for a wide range of diseases, things that are inherited, infectious diseases.
How do you know which piece of the genome and the DNA to look at? How do you know which piece to pull out from the larvae to examine?
We don't know where to look when we start out, so these things are quite difficult. The way it's done is you take a group of people that have developed a certain type of disease, and you take a group of people that haven't, and then you have a gigantic comparison. I mean, a human genome is 3 billion base pairs. That's a lot of comparisons, but that's the only way you can start to find places which might, in a certain group, the people that, say, develop cancer, they have certain variants that the group that don't develop cancer lack. So that's how we start. Once we have an idea of which genes might be important, we can grow cells in a dish and we can make mutations in those cells, similar to what we've seen in human populations, and start to look, do these cells become turn into cancer cells and look like that.
Are you saying that you take healthy cells and you turn them into cells which you know cause cancer, and you see that two things are the same?
Yeah, we can make mutations in those cells that mirror what we've seen in a population.
But you can make mutations to cells without having to know about the DNA of a person, can't you?
Each cell of the human body contains all the DNA, so each one of your cells has the same set of DNA.
I see. So effectively you're saying that every cell in the body has got all the DNA of your body.
Yeah, and that's the sort of code, the sort of reference book. And so your cell goes to that reference book and it makes certain proteins that make it into, say, a heart cell or a liver cell, but it all reads from the same book. It just doesn't make the same proteins.
How does a cell take its instructions from the DNA and say, right, I'm going to be an ear, not a liver?
So this refers to the bit of the genome that we don't understand about quite as well.
You don't understand.
Yeah,
I don't understand.
There's lots of things we don't
Carry
understand.
On.
DNA doesn't just have genes. There's bits of DNA in between the genes. And until recently, we didn't really know what this was for. We sort of referred to it as the junk DNA, because that was what we thought it was. But actually, it turns out that this DNA is what instructs the genes to switch themselves on and off. So this kind of more complicated region is larger than the genes itself. It's what decides whether your cell becomes a liver cell or a heart.
So this is a computer with a set of chemical software instructions to tell genes how to behave.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Right, okay. Any job vacancies here? So I understand what you're talking about now. So your genome, basically, with biological chemistry, analogy of which can be computing to some extent.
Yeah, or you could make it an analogy of a book, perhaps, and you only read out certain sentences.
Yes, but a book you have to read. It's got its self-fundamental program, and it then instructs other things what to do and what not to do at certain points in time. When you get to the cells which mutate, how do you know which piece of the DNA has actually caused that mutation? Which part of the instruction set? Is it the redundant DNA that you thought was redundant? It's not passing instructions correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it the actual DNA saying, I don't care what you tell me to do, I'm not going to do it?
How do we know? Okay, so when you compare your two populations, the one that has the disease and the one that doesn't have the disease, you're going to find lots of differences between these populations, because our DNA has differences. And some of these will be linked to the disease, and some of this will be completely irrelevant to the disease. It will be to do with our hair colour and our eye colour, and that's not the stuff we're interested in. So when you compare the populations, a whole sort of range of things come up, and then you have to sort of do biological testing to sort of narrow down into which ones are really causing the disease. And then we can start to look at, say, the proteins that these genes code for, and we can start to try to work out where they fit into biology and the things that go on inside your cells to sort of see whether these might be the cause.
So in this particular project you're looking at, which is basically trying to find out whether Salmonella has a genetic cause, how far have you got?
Salmonella is a bacterial pathogen, and you can roughly divide it into two branches. There's the gastrointestinal disease that a lot of us were familiar with if you don't cook your chicken properly, and also typhoid fever is actually caused by a different type of Salmonella bacteria. you couldn't say that it's a genetic disease. It's very much caused by a pathogen. But what we can say is how people respond to this disease. You know, some people will clear up the infection quite quickly, and some people will be sick for a very long time. We saw this in the swine flu outbreak. There were certain people, they were quite young, healthy people, that became extremely sick. And the kind of history as to why this was happening and sequencing shed some light on this by finding that the people that became extremely sick tended to contain a sort of variant in their genome that was causing this to happen.
So does that mean that you now have the answer to being able to repair that structure, that people don't get that particular disease?
As far as repairing it in the person's genome goes, we're not there yet. But say for the flu example, what we could do in a epidemic is perhaps sequence people and find out whether they're susceptible and prioritise these people for treatment.
So the same thing with Ebola, I suppose, that's going on at the moment.
If you know people are susceptible, then you can prioritise people for vaccination. Mm. So that sort of thing.
What sort of task is it to sequence somebody's DNA in order to be able to find out how long to take?
Well, if you want to sequence their whole genome, nowadays you need 2 days and about £1,000.
I mean, you're saying that if there was an outbreak and you wanted to concentrate your medical forces in the place where it would do the greatest good, one of the ways of doing it is to find out from genetic sequencing who's likely to catch it and who isn't.
Yep, that's...
But that still takes 2 days per person.
Well, so once we've worked out which bits of the genome might help us to understand whether people are susceptible, then we wouldn't need to look at their
whole
genome.
You just go that
stuff
apart.
Sequence a chunk, the chunk that we're interested in. And this is the same for all genetic testing. If we would only need to sequence a small piece, so actually the cost comes right down.
Now, if we're talking about a genome of 3 billion linear length, what's the telephone number of the particular genes that you actually want to get at? I mean, how do you identify it?
Right, you're asking all the technical questions.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, I know. So there's going to be differences, certain letters in the DNA code, the A, T, C, G code, right? But we know that the code, a lot of it between people is the same. And so at the site that we're interested in, we know what the code is nearby that site. And so we use the surrounding code and we can sort of target it by knowing what's nearby.
Is the code identifiable by a number? Can it be translated into a number or is it a chemical code?
It's a chemical code. So it's four bases for four chemical groups, shorten it ATCG.
Right.
These just repeat themselves in a different sequence all the way throughout the genome.
So you're saying that to get to the faulty one, you take about half a dozen either side of it, and then you say, right, that's probably where it's going to be, because in the other guys, it doesn't vary in that thing.
That's how we find
it. And is it always one piece, or is there another piece comes into the action as well in the cause of genetic disorder?
It completely depends on the disorder. For something complex like heart disease or cancer, there's thousands of places in the genome, hundreds, thousands. We don't even know how many at the moment influence these conditions. That's what researchers are still working on at the moment. Mm.
But every single cell contains every single instruction in your body. I mean, the mind boggles when you think the size of a cell, and then you think the size of the instruction code. What actually physically is it made of, the 3 billion letters?
The molecule is called deoxyribose nucleic acid, so it's a kind of acid and it's built into a chain.
They're all independent computers, if you like, and they're networked together by what you thought was redundant DNA, but you now believe it's a messaging pathways.
Yes.
When does the next stage come along when you're actually going to start repairing people's DNA so people will be prevented from getting the disease? And that's got to be the objective, isn't it? Not to find out what's wrong, but to find out how to cure it.
I don't think there's anything particularly going on at the moment with gene therapies that have been cleared as proper medical treatments, because things have to go through a lot of testing. The way the repaired DNA is delivered into the site to replace the faulty DNA involves using a virus to carry it in, because this is what viruses do. They bring sort of foreign DNA inside your cells, and this can lead to cancer, so it's obviously been one of the side effects in things that they've tried so far.
Jenny Hill there, explaining some of the practical approaches to DNA research. And for a final word on the subject, we return to Don Powell.
Many of the mutations, many of the variations that we find in people will have implications for their health in different ways. One of the good examples of that are mutations in gene involved in the immune system, like autoimmune diseases, where several diseases that have an autoimmune component, diabetes, inflammatory bowel disease, eczema, might have an underlying variant in a single gene that just plays a part. What we find most about genetics as we look at it today is we have many, many genes playing a part and playing a fairly small part. It's when you put them together that you get that full effect of what would be clinically diagnosed as disease. So the old picture we kind of have of sickle cell anemia and a gene and cystic fibrosis and a gene is not accurate for most of the diseases we have. Most of the diseases we have involve many genes working not as well as they should, or working more than they should, but not working within the normal range. And development of a drug, the regulatory authorities and the drug development companies are taking as much care as they can to produce something that's effective and is safe. And those have to be the two overriding principles. You have to show that the compound, the drug, is as safe as it can be, and you have to show it's effective, and it has to have both those attributes. I don't know how that can be shortened. There might be ways of trying to use computer biology in the future. There might be more clever ways we can look at the statistics that we get, the results we get out of trials that would improve efficiency. But it is a difficult and long process. If I were a terminal patient and there were a treatment that was unproven on the market, would I shout to try to get it? I suspect I probably would. But is that right? I don't know.
You've been listening to A Roving Report by Terry Meekin, where we've been at the Sanger Institute for Genetic Research into DNA. Roving Reports are a Terry Meekin production for Community Radio. Community Radio, daring to be different.